Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 389. My feet are tired because I went to a place that I almost didn't come back from today. Skydart and I are in Toronto, and we found the Pacific Mall in Markham. Is it Markham or Markham?
I like Markham better.
That's when Mark Hamill's in your entourage. Then you can go, yo, Mark Ham!
Anything with the word ham in it makes me...
What about John Ham? The extra M's for extra...
It makes me laugh and get wet.
What the fuck?
Wait, what? What?
Are you serious right now?
What?
What? What?
What? What?
What? What? What?
That's...
I can't. Oh, man. Why does it have to be someone I'm friends with? Why can't it be...
It's John Hamm. He makes fucking men wet. It's... Come on.
Okay. I will admit that my moisture levels are slightly increased, and there's a high pressure system bringing in some precipitation up in the southern regions. However... It should be someone
like
that you could. It should be someone
thing.
That. It should be someone that we wouldn't
it's
hang
in our
out
DNA.
With.
It's in our DNA. When you hear the words John Hamm, it just happens.
You have Hamm DNA. You have Hamm.
Hamm DNA. See, it fucking works every time.
All right. Well.
All right. Go
anyway,
finish
we
your intro.
We went to the Pacific. Thanks. We went to the Pacific Mall today in Markham, and it is an Asian mall that is a place that you never want to leave when you go in. It has everything. It's just filled with kiosks. I bought Lego Batman DC Super Heroes 2, and I think I bought it in French. So it's going to be like the older Lego games where they mumble, and it's not going to make any sense to me. I need a French class, stat! So I highly recommend the Pacific Mall. We got a lot of good, and green tea Kit Kats, and jeans.
Milk candy.
Oh, it was so great. So great. If you're in Canada, you should go there. And enjoy yourself. I would like to thank for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. Comedy Central Stand Up Direct. This, I am way behind this, especially because I happen to be on it. Mandroid is now available on CC Stand Up Direct for $5. It can be yours with unlimited downloads, streams on any device. Check it out. The website's direct.cc.com. And right now there's 22 other fantastic specials that will... Hopefully not eat into your podcast listening time, but I would understand if they did. Todd Barry specials on there, Owen Benjamin, Matt Bronger, Hannibal Buress, Bo Burnham, me, Pete Holmes, Jeselnik, Kinane, Joe Coy, Kroll, Al Madrigal, Dimitri, TJ, Merman, John Mulaney, Kumail, Jeff Ross, I'm just going to read them all because they're all fantastic. Jeff Ross, Kristen Shaw, JB Smoove, Nick Swardson, Paul F. Tompkins, and Tosh. So that is right now at direct.cc.com. And thank you so much to Comedy Central, not only for putting it up there, thanks for giving me a show, but how about we start there? But then also thanks for putting the special up on Comedy Central Stand Up Direct for $5. This episode is Ken Levine, who is one of the co-founders and the creative director of Irrational Games. Irrational is responsible for Bioshock. Chloe and I played the shit out of Bioshock Infinite. It's one of my favorite games of all time now, and... this is actually very timely because there's some DLC. So if you have the season pass, there's some DLC that's available. Clash in the Clouds, which looks to me, just from the YouTube video that I saw, looks basically like a combat mode. And then also Burial at Sea, which seems to take place. It seems to be Rapture related. So if you're a fan of Bioshock, those happen to come out today. So this is the perfect time to release the Ken Levine podcast, who was fantastic, by the way. There are tons of spoilers in here for Bioshock Infinite, because we grill him on all the stuff we wanted to know, and if you have the guy who's a creative director, you're going to pin him down and ask these questions. We pinned him down gently. We just said John Hamm, and then he went limp, and then we just asked him a bunch of questions. And then also, Ken is writing Logan's Run. They're doing another Logan's Run, and he is writing it because he does not have any problem whatsoever with good story, because the Bioshock series is freaking phenomenal, and he's also a huge sci-fi geek. So this was a blast, and you can follow Ken on Twitter at IG Levine. That would be Irrational Games Levine. And here you go, Nerds Podcast number 389 with Ken Levine. Good talk. We had a very good talk.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Ken Levine has joined us in the, I don't know what to call this, Cloud City.
It's Bespin.
Did you just reference Bioshock?
What?
Did you just reference Bioshock?
I was referencing Empire.
Empire Strikes Back.
Sorry.
Yeah, I know.
My bad.
Yeah, no worries. Because
That's the gray hair in the room. Like, oh, what do you mean?
No, it's Bespin.
So what do you mean? You old pirate. We just shot a video with him to promote our lightsaber relay run. We recreated the cantina and had this guy who made all these creatures for a Volkswagen commercial let us use like 18 of his cantina creatures. And we had Billy D. Williams singing. Like, we basically created what was like, hey, what if it were karaoke night at Mos Eisley? And so we had him singing and all the creatures. And
guess who he played?
I had to play Han.
Oh.
He's had to. You're forced.
I tried to get Nathan Fillion to do it. I was like, he'd be a much better Han Solo. And it was literally the only one that didn't have. I would have just been in the background. I didn't give a shit.
I don't know what part to feel bad about. I said, well, I tried to get Nathan Fillion to play, but I guess I had.
I'm so tired of taking Nathan's parts. Just again and again. Okay, Fillion, I will take another part for you.
Well, you're mistaken for him all the time. Too, right?
I mean, it's really embarrassing. It's constant. Yeah, it's constant. People, I'm like, no, not Castle. I'm not Castle. but it's really great to have you here. We had a conversation right after I started playing Infinite, which I gotta say was it's fucking unreal. That game is unreal, and I'm sure it's gonna win all the awards. And then when we talked, by the way, I will tell people that there will be spoilers on this podcast because, you know, we're going to talk about stuff.
It's been 2 months. Get over it.
Money, you should take that quote and put it on the front of the box for Bioshock Infinite.
It's been two months. Get over it.
Ken Levine.
if I tweet anything remotely spoiler, like even my followers, like, what? How did you spoil the game? I'm like, yeah. You're my follower. If you're not going to buy the game by now, you're probably not going to buy it.
I had no idea the chicken lady played Bioshock Infinite, which was the voice you just did. Why did you play that? How could you say? But you told me when I was talking to you, I was actually just about to enter Comstock House. Mm-hmm. And you said, yeah. Okay, look, you're either going to fucking hate my guts for the ending or you're going to love it. And
how many people hated it? Are there people who hated the ending?
I think there are people I think there were some people who were...
Oh, devastated by like the of what happened, not mad at you.
No, I think there were people they were frustrated that they didn't like get, like it wasn't fully clear
right.
to them, and they didn't like the fact that there was sort of a bit of opacity there. Mm-hmm. And so I think there were some people who were really like, no, I don't get this.
But you know what's so great about it is that that is essentially like theoretical physics. It's just trying to wrap your mind around like Schrodinger's cat stuff. Like, oh, is it? Okay, so there's all these different parallel things, and when they're observed, then this reality can happen and this reality, but it was just the idea of – and then what I loved about it is that it just totally brought the title, and you're like, oh, got it! Like, to me, it just wrapped everything up in a nice little bow.
I mean, this is the thing about quantum mechanics is as little as I understand of it, every time I try to understand it, your brain just wants to say, like, no, don't – it's okay, Ken, don't. Don't try to figure this out, pretty boy. It's like people call me pretty boy.
Of course, yeah. Well, like I'm Fillion.
Yes.
Yeah.
We have this problem.
Yeah. Stop it, everyone. Please. Please just let us be alone with our looks.
Our handsomeness.
I'm just swooning. I can't stop swooning right now.
I think it's because there's no air in here.
Oh, maybe. Yeah. Yeah, right.
It is. It's one of those things you start. Like we had a physicist come in from MIT just as a consultant. And she'd start to talk, and it is just one of those things that your brain really is just not designed to understand.
I think a lot of theoretical physicists
don't understand. No.
They're like, well, it's Zora. I mean, because there's no – I remember the first time I tried to read a book on when they were searching for the Higgs boson in like 91. This book dates back to 91. It took me forever to read the book because every time you you have nothing. I had nothing to relate it to. It is so foreign of a concept to what we experience that I kept having to stop and be like, okay, what can I compare this to? I have nothing to anchor this to try to go, oh, this is what it is.
I think actually the best explanation I ever read is, of any of this kind of stuff, is what Moore did in Watchmen, you know, the Dr. Manhattan stuff.
Right.
Did a pretty good job of getting a sense of what it was like to be a person who could experience time in a different, you know,
with a big blue
dick. Not as a linear, with a giant blue penis.
Yeah.
Which is also somebody you're mistaken for.
Constantly. I'm mistaken for the penis.
Yeah. It's really blue.
Dr. Manhattan's dick, what are you doing around? Leave me alone. I'm trying to exist here and on Mars. I'm going to build an ice castle on Mars, and then I'll be back after everyone. I'll take the heat on this one, and then I'll come back in a century or so. But it really was... I mean, I thought the story was cool, but I also just... I mean, the game design was just stunning. Stunning. And you said, how long did you say you guys worked on?
Like 4.5 years. It was a long cycle. Yeah.
Are you just over it by the end? Or are you like, I can't, I'm just.
You're over it, but you're also like, if you really love a game you're working on, you're really passionate about it, you could always spend more time on it. And so like, they really had to pull it. Like there was a pencils down moment in like December for me, because I had to go down the press tour. And you're really, and even now, I can't really play for anything I work on, because you always look back on, I wish I had time to do this, I wish I had time to do that, but that can go on forever. At some point, you know, you got to say, you know, okay, enough's enough, move on.
Yeah. Were there some elements that you were really attached to that you just couldn't? I guess this isn't just for BioShock, but as someone, when you're creating a game and you're literally building the universe, you must have some ideas going in. Like, here's a thing that I want to happen. And then once the rest of the story kind of starts revealing itself, are there things that you're like, shit, I guess I got to let this thing go that I loved?
Yeah, you run out of narrative room, you know? Sometimes, like Daisy Fitzroy is a character who I wish I had more time, more running time to develop. But you have to make choices along the way. Like, it really, at the end of the day, it was like people asked me as we were developing, like, oh, is this a game about American exceptionalism? Is this a game about quantum mechanics? Is this a game of this? And at the end of the day, it was really a game about Booker and Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. It was really about their story. And everything else was secondary to that story, and the story of, you know, what happened to Booker and how he became, spoilers, everybody, so turn it off, don't yell at me, how he became Comstock and that moment of bifurcation. But, So you have to make choices, and you choose, like any other creative endeavor, you say, well, what matters here? Do you want to go further in that story, further in this story, or do you want to stay with Booker and Elizabeth? And we always would choose Booker and Elizabeth.
But what's awesome about games rather than movies, I mean, movies don't really have an equivalent to this, but with games, you can be like, man, I'll just toss in the DLC. You know what I mean? Like, if you wanted to really go into Daisy Fitzroy's story a little bit more, you could always just do a DLC pack, you know?
Yeah, there's other places that one of my guys wrote a book, extended short story about Daisy, and there's a board game coming out, and there's could be comic books maybe. And, you know, you have all these other places you could do that stuff. But the problem with, you know, telling a story, particularly in games, is that it's telling any story is really expensive, hugely expensive. It's, you know, so you have to make your choices.
Mm-hmm. We are cosplaying.
Here's the, this is a
very awkward
story.
We decided to cosplay as Booker and Elizabeth.
No, really?
Before we had finished the game. And so, shut up, Pat. And so, started making the costumes. And then we're way too far along. And then we're like, she's his what?
Yeah. We get to the end, and I'm like, whoa, that was awesome. Oh,
you're like planning a romantic evening around the costumes.
So we're going to be at San Diego Comic-Con, and if there's any point where we're like making out of these characters, we're like, this was before we finished it. Is there any reality where they're not that related in that way? There's got to be some reality. Yeah. Where they're,
I mean,
well, people ask me all along when I was made, like, oh, so tell me about the romance. And I'm like, because I obviously couldn't like say, right. Well, there's, of course there's not.
Yeah.
Right.
But that was an awkward question. And I sort of had to figure out how to answer that question without telling people.
I first started hearing about the game, I remember I was looking it up. Like, I was so excited about this. And then I saw somebody was saying that the relationship between Booker and Elizabeth was like a father-daughter. I actually read something like that. I remember reading that, and I was like, oh man, bummer. But I totally, it blew my mind. Even though I'd heard that, I still didn't even think that that was the case. Like,
yeah, it was weird because usually you expect an attractive male, an attractive female character in any kind, almost any kind of media, mm-hmm. there'd be some kind of connection there. But I found actually writing it, there's a look in any kind of setup when you're telling a story, there's always a, it takes work to get a romance going. Like, you know, like they have to, or it just feels fake, you know, mm-hmm. like romance happens usually, you know, game is what, 8 hours long, 10 hours, 12, 15 hours, whatever it is, or movie 2 hours long. There's always a bit of forcing that goes on there. Things happen very quickly. Certainly falling in love.
Yeah. I mean,
people could be attracted, but falling in love in that period of time is actually a very limited period of time. It's really, there's some artificiality there, but having the kind of relationship I found it very natural to write that kind of intimacy between the two of them because I didn't even have to incorporate that element, but they still felt to me like very much like when you find out their relationship, it felt like it worked and I didn't have to sort of, it would have been an extra layer, even if in a totally different story, to write that romantic element on top of it.
There's got
to
be one universe where they're in bed together and Comstock comes in and he's like, oh, whoa. No.
Should have mentioned something.
Oh, no.
There's always old boy.
Well, I was trying to figure out how many universes he had smashed through from the very beginning, from when we first see him, or what if it was recursive, or if, you know, but just the idea of like, oh, you know, it's okay. Every time he gets a nosebleed, that's a whole different universe's set of experiences that are like mashing into his brain. Did you have it mapped out somewhere, or is it sort of nebulous?
We did a lot of whiteboard mapping stuff out because, frankly, for us, we had to keep it, you know, as we developed it, we had to keep it all in our heads. Like everything, it's all like, there's, as far as I know, there's almost no, like, ever, there is nothing that doesn't actually make sense, like from a logical, practical standpoint. Some of it's fairly opaque in terms of how we chose to tell the story. Like, for instance, you know, there's a element of Comstock's past and why he's as racist as he is, which is really buried very deep. But it's there. It's just buried very, very deep. And only a couple of people have picked up on it. But we mapped everything. There's lots of whiteboards and lots of drawings and lots of, like, you know, lines and this going, like, back and forth.
Why they have to be whiteboards? Why they have to be whiteboards? Did Comstock make that up?
You know, I'm obviously.
I never picked up on that. Like, what was it? What? I mean, yeah. since we're talking about stuff.
There's an audio log where he talks about being in the army and how people would have. The implication is that people thought he had Native American blood
in him, right.
A teepee in his family tree. And his reaction, what he did at Wounded Knee was to show people that he was on their team.
Oh, he just got super racist.
Yes. And you know, that sort of goes back to, if you look at, like, you know, like, oh God, who is that politician who died? He ran for president in 48. He was married to, he had a black child. And he ran on a segregationist platform this overcompensation, the Ted Haggards of the world.
Right.
These guys are all constantly overcompensating for the fact that there's something about themselves that they feel.
Gays shouldn't marry. And then that guy is blowing a dude in a bathroom thing.
Did you hear what happened recently? That the main people that were trying to turn gays straight, I can't remember the name of the
Exodus.
Yeah. The guy came out and he's like, I'm sorry. I'm actually gay. Like, he's, and I'm like, I'm really sorry, guys.
I read his apology, but did he acknowledge being gay?
He said, I've been trying to fight the urges for a long time. And, like, yeah, he was really genuinely sorry. And that just happened. It's crazy.
Yeah.
That you guys made that reference.
Because I do remember that audio log.
I'm just always been interested in these people who, instead of just accepting what the hell they are, they go through all these sort of backward handstands to, like, hey, I'm gay. It's all right. It's cool. Don't worry about it. Instead, you have to, like, create this ridiculous life where you're teaching people how to come out of homosexuality through some kind of conversion therapy, which, of course, doesn't exist, you know, causing endless amounts of misery,
trauma.
You know, instead of just saying, hey, I'm gay. It's cool. Or, hey, I'm a Native American. It's cool. And Comstock was, you know, and that, I don't necessarily know how he, you know, at the time, you know, like, that was – people ask me about the racism in the game, and the game is not like, the world of Columbia is not particularly racist for the time it was. I mean, there were certain parts of the country, and but it's, casual racism was very, 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 it was the standard then. The notion of, you know, somebody being, you know, Irish or Jewish or Native American, that, you know, there was, it was openly racist at the time. And
1912.
I think people thought we were trying to make a larger point than we actually were, as compared to trying to actually just portray the period as it was. I'm not just being like postmodern, you know, knee-jerk lefty here. It really just was, you know, a time where that was just a casual part of society.
But yeah. The earlier Bioshocks were kind of, I mean, I don't know necessarily if they were making a statement, but I mean, you know, with the Ayn Rand novel and all of the correlations there, I feel like, you know, we kind of expect big statements from Bioshock.
Yeah, you know, I think that the I think part of it is a function of that. Yeah, we sort of set ourselves up for that. Yeah. Like, you know, we sort of do that. And I think probably being as much of a history nerd as I was, as I wrote the thing, it seemed very natural that that would be a part of that society. And that's why every time we showed something, people would react to, oh my God, this is what the game's about. This is what the game's about. And for me, the game is always about Booker and Elizabeth. But I can't really blame people because I think that the average person doesn't necessarily, like, you know, have a really clear picture of 1912 and what it was like. Right. And generally when media does show something like racism, it sort of becomes the focus because it's such a hot button topic.
The only thing I remember about 1912 is that the Titanic is unsinkable and that the heart of the ocean lies at the bottom of the ocean because she had to let Jack go. She had to let him go.
That is the only thing that matters about 1912.
That was the only thing that matters. But that's the 1912 I know. But if you're saying there's some other fucking world up in a cloud, Ken, okay, I'm fine with that.
You're okay with that?
Yeah, I'm okay with it. That's suspended by some sort of a quantum idea that just keeps everything held in place.
Science.
Yeah,
science.
It's science. It's totally science. I'm waiting for the day when someone like yourself comes along and you're like, well, I want to write this game and here's the science that's involved in this game, and then they're helping you write it and then they discover something where
– Well, actually, we found – so I had this sort of – the theory for how the city was held up is like something I sort of like made up and pulled out of my butt, and then I went to talk to the that it was this particle that was constantly moving. There was a single particle that was constantly moving backwards in time, like a second back in time, each second that went by. So it was basically staying in position.
Because it never falls, because it never goes forward. That's mind-bendy.
So I thought of that, like, oh, I'm really smart. And then I actually talked to the physicist, and she's like, well, yeah, sort of, kind of. But then there's like 500 issues that would cause problems. But then I saw this. There's this YouTube video, this thing called quantum...
Tunneling?
Levitation. No, quantum levitation, where there's actually, they have this disc that's suspended, like, and it's like a piece of dry ice or something. It's suspended over a magnetic field, and it floats, and like it sits there, and you can like turn an angle, and sit there,
I've
and
seen
it float.
That. It's really cool.
A continual lane. You ever seen it?
I have not.
Science, man.
It's like science. It's real.
Mind blowing.
God damn it! But it is. But I do believe that more scientists should work with artists. Because the artists are the ones that they don't necessarily think scientifically right away. They just go, oh, what if this were possible? Yep. And then some scientists can come along and go, oh, actually, I might be able to connect the dots for you and figure that out.
I mean, that's what we did on both these games. Basically, I thought of some big, stupid idea, and I talked to some scientists. They go, well, you know, if you do this, well, after Bioshock 1, Wired wanted to do an interview about the science of Bioshock 1. And I was like, well, you know, you can modify your genetics all you want, but bees are never going to fly out of your hand, no matter what
you
do.
Right.
And so it was a little awkward because I think they thought I had really thought it out to a degree that I had not thought it out to.
That's Kyle. Is there music playing down there?
Yeah, you want me to go get it?
Yeah, yeah. Just go ask them to turn it down. No, how about this? You demand. Put your foot down.
I will get satisfaction
in a nice way. But I want to. What?
I have a quick question, really quick.
Sure.
Okay. There's a part when the songbird dies and he makes this screechy noise.
Yeah.
But in the, I think, usually he already knows my math. Sorry, let me explain. You can hear the exact same sound that the songbird makes in that game, in the first game.
Here's the thing I won't talk about.
Oh.
I don't want to, like one thing that I think is, I like about the game is that people have a lot of theories about various things. Like there are things that are factual, like Comstock talks about, you know, being potentially Native American. That's like in a log. But I don't want to like say yes or no to things that are more
opaque.
But okay. I love the fact that people are debating like this stuff because it's lets them like I'm a guy like I'm like a 2001 guy. I'm a Paul Thomas Anderson, the master guy. I'm like a guy who likes that opacity and things. Mm-hmm. And so I've been really trying to avoid getting involved in like, you know, like going out in interviews and saying this means that, or, oh, that's true. Or, you know, people, there's a lot of theories and, you know, maybe true, maybe not about like the, you heard about the 122 theory?
No.
There's some bells at the beginning of the game when you go into the lighthouse mm-hmm. and you hit the first one once, the second one twice, and the third one twice. And then there's when you meet the Lutesses the second time when they have the coin flip thing, yeah. There's 122 marks on the
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, there's a debate going back and forth about the meaning of that. And people ask me, what does it mean? And I don't want to – I'd rather people – what does it matter what I think?
So I have a question for you then. As a storyteller, at what point do you feel that a storyteller has a responsibility to share things with the audience and not share things with the audience? For instance, you know, like you know, midichlorians. Do we really need to know what the Force was? I don't know. You know, probably not. Yeah. But then, you know, when so like we're fine just knowing like, well, there's a Force in the universe. And then I've heard other people, like people on shows, people who write on shows or who write movies that have a certain amount of, you know, a mysterious element that they never explain. And they go, oh, well, you know, it's sort of like the Force. And then sometimes you go, no, but that you should explain. Like, where do you feel the responsibility lies with the storyteller to, like, what information do you think the person should have?
Well, this is interesting because, you know, I think it's a great question because at the end of the game, I think there's a lot of people who were frustrated because like, well, I want to know, like, well, I don't understand. What does this mean? What does that mean? And part of it is the quantum mechanics thing. It's just that even if I explained it, it wouldn't make any sense because people generally, unless they have, and I'm not one of those people, I'm not claiming I have this background, but unless you have a deep background in quantum mechanics, the whole thing doesn't make sense. Like the idea of infinite realities, which is sort of mathematically, well, there's a many worlds theory. Mm-hmm. And certainly something is going on. That light is both, you know, light when it's observed is both a particle and a wave. Mm-hmm. Like that's true, at least from a math, as much as we can mathematically know. And that has certain implications. Now, one implication may be that there's infinite number of universes and there are these sort of infinite splits for every microcosmic decision can be made, splits into the other universe. That's called the many worlds theory. Whether that's true or not is up for debate whether that's true, but it is true that light is both a part, can be observed both simultaneously as a particle and a wave in two different states. And that's where, you know, Schrodinger's cat is sort of comes from that thought experiment comes from that. So there are things that like just are inexplicable about it just because brains aren't really designed to know. But then there's things about, you know, well, what is the ending, you know, where you see, did you guys see the coda?
Yes, you know, where he goes into the room and she's in there. Yeah.
You know, like, what's that about? Well, is she in there? I mean, that's another question. You know, he says Anna, but you don't actually, is she in the cradle?
Oh, so is that a little quantum mechanics Easter egg?
That's what people, when people ask me, is she in that cradle? Well, is the cat?
Yeah.
I'd love to know with something like this, where you start this story. Seriously. Like, because the idea, when I sort of was able to grasp the idea of, you know, and I think I'm right about this, that that Elizabeth has the ability to make tears because her finger gets cut off when they made a mechanical tear. And so now she's existing in two different universes. And so now that means that she's spread out across, like mm-hmm. she has the ability to cross the universe. Is that an idea that you had to stumble upon to justify it, or for early on, were you like, this is going to be the thing that basically unfolds the whole story?
So the pinky actually was a way for us to explain visually what she was. That came on super late. If you go back and you look at earlier demos, and I'll be honest here, we didn't have that notion in earlier demos because we were going, we're going to have to explain all that. We knew we were going to a place where we'd have to explain it, but what you have to explain and how you explain it, it's critically important how you explain it. It doesn't matter what you're explaining if you don't have a good way to explain it. So that's something that occurred to me on a run, that we could have a visual element that you had seen the entire time that would both explain that's the moment you realize who she is, that this, that the baby is Elizabeth, but it also is the sort of the explanation, you know, the background of the explanation of why, you know, why she, how she exists in multiple universes. But we knew we had to have her, we knew we wanted her to be a we needed a reason why she was special. And we just sort of for the longest time said, we'll figure that out. and we didn't have that. And that's sort of,
well, that goes back to your question that you were asking, like, where do you feel the responsibility to explain everything? And you, I mean, she could have just been.
That was definitely one of those things. That's one of those things you have to, I feel like you have to try to explain. You can't not, you're just be like, because if you don't, if you can't wrap your mind around why she has that ability, then it's just like a deus ex machina. It's like, oh, so right, she's just a weird freak?
You're completely right. I think we knew we needed to explain that. We could, I think we just said she's just a unique snowflake, but that probably wouldn't have – the audience, I think, would have rightly probably said, hey, you know, you guys go fuck yourselves.
Right.
I didn't think about this. But – so we knew we had to explain something about why she was. It just happened that all those things sort of dovetailed into explaining – you know, that moment explained a bunch of things for us, you know, that it was that when you saw, you know, the finger, Jane chopped off, you had seen her with her finger off the whole time. But that was something we came in fairly late. And all of a sudden we realized we wanted her missing a finger. And so all those animations where you see her, like, you know, at the very beginning, reacting to that stuff, we added very relatively late in the day because it became the way we could explain all this stuff. But I also thought, like, oh, well, it's also a nice character thing for her. It's a nice mystery that's hiding in plain sight the entire time. But it was one of those things that we knew we had to explain. We just didn't honestly know how to.
Well, in a minute, I'm gonna get up Bioshock Infinite because I'm sure you probably have talked about it a lot in the last several months. But I do have one more question, which is and then I asked Reddit to ask some questions because they had questions and I want people to you know, that was Chloe's idea, and so and I actually did get a bunch of questions, so I want to in our gaming
good
wanna,
ones not scary ones
not yeah. scary ones
but it's just from a creator standpoint, was the seed of the note, was the notion of this game, like, what was your original idea when you first had the concept of this game? Was it to tell the story of choices and redemption and changing, and or was it, well, we want to have this game that's sort of a, you know, a guy running through this world and there's a,
what's the opposite of underwater?
Yeah. Like what was the, where did the idea originate?
There's a napkin that our art director did, Scott Sinclair did. And I wish I had a visual for you here, which when we started working, it was a wave. And then a house. This was the art direction Bible for Bioshock Infinite. It was a wave and then a little house at the bottom underneath the water. And it said no. And then a wave and a cloud and a house above it. And you said yes.
So basically, so that was the opposite direction of underwater.
and, you know, we oh, here it is.
Oh, you have it? Oh, my gosh. Here.
Thanks, Mayor.
Oh,
my wife
shit.
Just found it.
That's really funny.
That is. Have you posted this anywhere online?
Yeah. You guys can, if you want to, if I can get it to you.
Yeah, I would love to. Well. That's really funny.
Great.
Yeah, so Scott Sinclair had that. And it's like he wrote it. It's like you can see like food stains on it and stuff. he did it at lunch someday. But, you know, we knew we wanted to do something. We knew the only thing we had at the beginning is we liked the city and we liked the time period. Because it was sort of a really untouched time period, besides, as you said, the pearl, what, the blue?
Or the heart of the ocean?
The heart of the ocean.
Yeah.
So you've got that. You got that. That's close to your heart. I could see you've got that. Right.
Yeah,
so.
Near, far, wherever you are.
I can't wait for the Titanic video game.
I believe that.
Who do you think would make the Titanic video game? What studio do you think would make the Titanic video game?
Fuck, spoiler alert, we're doing it.
What?
Shit. Well, they did. They did project. The Douglas Adams.
Another,
like,
underwater?
They did. I've talked about this in the podcast before. One of my favorite games was an adaptation of Douglas Adams' story with Starship Titanic, and they did a PC game, Starship Titanic, and it's fucking gorgeous. Did you ever play it, Kyle? It's really cool, but basically you're on this, and I think it's Terry Jones, maybe it's one of the Pythons, but I think it's Terry Jones. It kind of narrates the game, and you're alone on this Starship Titanic, and it's a puzzle game, and you have to go through and do a bunch of crazy shit, but it's fucking gorgeous. I mean, it was sort of like, imagine a Douglas Adams version of like Myst.
It's
It's like in the 90s?
Yeah, late 90s. I remember playing it on PC, Starship Titanic, and it's a fucking gorgeous game. And so I love that. So someone did a version of it, but no one's done that.
We should remake it and put zombies on it.
I'll tell you what happened is James Cameron would just be like, I'm going to invent a game engine. At the bottom of the ocean. He'll just fucking do it.
Here. I always feel like I have to out laugh Kyle. Now.
You can't.
I don't think I can.
You can't out laugh Kyle.
Look, basically, we're just behind. You know, we're just whatever Cameron does. You know, he did Underwater, and 5 years later, we did Underwater. He did Avatar.
He did.
Now we're in the sky.
Now we're in the clouds. Now you're in the clouds.
You know, we like the period. We felt it was fairly untapped. Like, not a lot of people have done games in this period. We like the art from the period, like all the forward-looking art from the period. You saw like lots of idealistic like science fiction, and the notion of a city in the clouds, and the religious element sort of came out of that.
I'm so bummed because I bought the BioShock soundtrack hoping to get God Only Knows the quartet version of it, and it's not on there. And I imagine because it's probably a really hard to license to sell that.
Yeah, I love to do that soundtrack.
It's on YouTube.
I know. I've watched it.
The
times.
Economics of doing that soundtrack would be like,
oh yeah,
deadly.
But
like, those things are
soundtrack
expensive.
Is so amazing. I mean, it's chilling. Like all of the songs on there, and Elizabeth's cover that song.
Isn't she great, Courtney the Draper? Oh,
Courtney,
beautiful voice.
It's insane.
We that was like my favorite, like the reason I put that video at the end. I was like, because usually like you're in a studio, you and like 500 other nerds, and you're like hanging out one day with like these two like beautiful actors, and they start like singing and playing guitar together, and you're like, you kind of feel like you're hanging out with the popular kids all of a sudden. So I'm like, oh, I want to prove I hung out with the popular kids. So I put that video.
That's right. And Troy Baker was the voice.
Troy,
yeah.
We just saw Troy at E3.
Yeah,
he's such a nice guy. And the acting in the game is fantastic as well. It's just all around, it's just a great game, and I'll slobber all over that game's knob forever. I don't care. I mean, I was bummed when I finished it because I'm like, now I'm done. What do you have a favorite vigor weapons combo?
I like the crows.
Oh, you like crows.
And I always like a shotgun. I go back to Doom.
Yeah,
know, shotguns. I just like crows, birds, shotguns.
I was shotgun and sniper.
Yeah,
were my two favorite. And then
I love
Bucking Bronco and Hell's Kiss. Those are my two. Like, yeah. You raise them in the air and just fucking light them up.
Yep.
Those are my faves.
We're gonna get we're making those vigor bottles for the Devil's Kiss. We're gonna sell them. I'll send you a
thank. What's gonna be in it?
You'll have to drink it.
Shit. And then my arm starts getting all crazy and weird.
Yeah, you guys would make the best cocktails.
We had actually at our BioShock 1 launch party, they had somebody, some like, I don't know, what do you call it, caterer made like plasmid themed cocktails.
Oh, that's awesome.
They were good.
We should just do a pop-up bar like a Comstock house and then just fucking everything inside.
So you'll come back and be the next Nerdist thing. You're just like, you'll find that your team has already done it.
I know. That's what happens here. Like, you guys already did a Comstock house? Yeah, it was great.
Where were you?
But I want to sort of, you know, just because there's so many areas that I want to ask, things I want to ask about, and then we'll get to some Reddit questions. But did you start in the game industry, or you were right? I mean, I know you, it was like a 97 maybe. Is Irrational go back to 97?
Yeah, we started in 97. Yeah.
Yeah. But then before that, did you want to write for television and film? Where I'm leading with this is Logan's Run, but did you want to do television and film? And you're like, you know, I think there's a lot of really great narrative things to be happening. Cause you know, in the 80s, there wasn't as much. You couldn't really tell as much of a story in video games just because of technological limitations. Yeah. But in the 90s, is that where you're like, I want to do theatrical stuff, but I really feel like there's a future with gaming.
I mean, I was a screen. I moved to LA in like 89 or something, like a long time ago when I got out of college, a couple years ago, then I got out of college and I got a job writing a movie for Paramount, like some horrible romantic, a rewrite of some horrible romantic comedy.
Did it get made?
It was terrible, and I made it slightly less terrible. and it was really like, I was young, and I was like, I came out here, and like all of a sudden I had all these new buddies who were taking me to Spago, and they really liked me. And then it turns out like I was just the, you know, kid writer, new writer number 7,942, and it was kind of heartbreaking for me. And I kind of freaked out and like bailed. Like, I just was not ready. I was not ready for that intersection of art and commerce at the time. I was just too young for it. And I became a computer consultant and like graphic designer for like 7 years. And then all of a sudden I was like, oh my God, I'm like going to turn 30 and I don't know what I'm going to do with my life. And I applied for a job at this company, Looking Glass. And when I was like 28 or 29, I got the job. And then like a year and a half later, I started Irrational. I just always played games. I don't think I was even thinking about being a storyteller in games. I think that's probably why they hired me, but I just wanted to, I just thought it was cool to make games. And then I realized once I got in that the, as you said, the bar was pretty low at that point for storytelling in games. And I, as a guy who loved film and loved TV, the kind of stories that I liked, I didn't really see represented. Like, you know, the first game I worked on was a game called Thief, and it's basically this film noir character. You know, he's basically like a Sam Spade or, you know, any, you know, film noir detective character. And I basically just lifted that whole idea out of film noir and put it into a, you know, a medieval setting. And it was felt original and unique, not because I sort of came up with film noir, just because I figured out like, oh, this whole kind of storytelling is just not, doesn't exist in games. Games are at that point were very much like, you know, either space aliens or, you know, Dungeons and Dragons.
Mm-hmm. Or just some sort of a side scrolling thing where you're like, yeah, you just go through and shoot stuff. And then there's
punch
a
stuff
and- there's a goal at the end. Yeah, you kick and punch and shoot. And then
yeah, it's pretty- there just wasn't the place, there wasn't room to tell any story, you know, there or the mechanism to tell any story, really. You know, there wasn't the technology to tell the story.
There's such a huge responsibility with the video game because, you know, the movie, it's 1.5 to 2.5 hours of someone's life. And they're basically just a voyeur. And with a video game, people are – they just meld with it. I think, and I think that's why the gaming community is more passionate than any other consumer because they basically form these fucking Vulcan mind melds with games.
Well, they're
and
engaged.
They control them and they're engaged for like, you know, 12, 13 – I mean
– I always consider a game good if I can't stop thinking about it when I'm not playing it. Like right now, I'm thinking about a little bit about Last of Us right now. I'm just like thinking about where I'm going to go next. And I mean, that was the same with Bioshock Infinite. I couldn't stop thinking about it when I wasn't playing it. I'm like, when am I going to get to play that again? You know? And
well, because it's by definition, you're engaged in a way that you're not because it requires, it asks things of you. You can't sort of fall asleep playing it, you know, the way you can fall asleep watching a movie or something like that.
I thought I was a cowboy for a month during Red Dead Redemption.
well, because like in Red Dead, like you could go just ride around and all of a sudden like the rain comes in over the horizon and then you decide to go sit down in front of your campfire and it's just that kind of experience that nobody's telling you, okay, it's time to move on. It's time to move on. It's, and that's why I think that, you know, that game, if somebody had told me that one of the most compelling gameplay experiences for me would be just riding over her, you know, towards a horizon when the rain, when the storm comes in
and the music
playing, it just makes this beautiful experience. You just don't have anywhere else because it's your experience, you know, it's your moment. And that's why in terms of storytelling, I never really liked cutscenes because I wanted, even if it's hard or even if the story, even if you miss things, a lot of the confusion over Infinite comes across the fact that people miss certain things. You know, they don't see it. They don't find the audio log. But I, as a gamer, that's what makes games unique is the ability that it's, you can miss stuff. But when you find something or when you have that moment, maybe you'll never catch that sunset exactly the way the artist intended you to in Red Dead. But when you do, you know, when you catch that moment, it's something incredible, something powerful that no other media has it. No other media at all.
Yeah, I sort of like that because we had Randy Pitchford on a couple of weeks ago. I haven't posted the podcast yet, but just there does seem to be this sort of fraternity of studio heads who all sort of talk and you know, like you said, you're chatting with your friends with Gabe and Randy. I think he said did he have you come play Borderlands? And
yeah, he came out to. I mean, he's a sweetheart. He came out like Randy, this incredibly busy guy, came out to play Infinite when we were sort of getting near the end to give us his feedback. And it was incredibly helpful. Well, all these guys, Jake Solland, who worked on XCOM and Randy and like a bunch of other people, there's people are very generous with their, in the indie games industry with their time and their, he played the whole game through. I mean, that's not trivial.
He
went out to Boston to play the whole game through. And that's not a trivial, you know, task to ask of somebody
who's
really busy, but he did. He was a real,
have you seen the industry change since 97?
Well, the money's obvious. There's a lot more money, a lot more marketing people. Not necessarily a lot more money for the people who make the game. So there's, there's a lot more money out there. The consoles are much bigger. I think the audience. I think the audience has grown. Obviously, I think there's some. I think that I think one of the reasons we talked about fans and the intensity of the fans. I think part of it is, as you said, they're engaged in a way they're not in other media because they play the games and they have that level of engagement, but they're also equally engaged with the dialogue. You know, I have, I don't know how many Twitter followers, and I talk back, you know, I'm constantly engaged with them and they tell me, you know, very frankly what they think, you know, sometimes. and that's great. And I think that's, you know, that's very common in the game space. I don't know how common that is in other forms of media, but I think because games are so new, almost all the things we think about when we come to the internet, you know, whether it's LOL or FTW, all that stuff comes out of the game space originally, you know, out of the internet nerd space. And so it's always been a very interactive, all that interactivity started in the game space. So I think there's really good stuff that level of interactivity. I think there's also a sense that something I don't really connect to as a gamer, like I'm a fan, like, and I like games and I like movies and I like comics. I don't worry about like if a game I'm going to like is going to be good or bad. I don't have a ton of anxiety. I don't have a ton of emotion. If I like it, I like it and I play it and I'm excited. If I don't like it, I kind of move on. But there's this sort of there's been a level of intensity and a level of anger sometimes even, which I guess I get, but I don't personally feel.
Right.
I don't know if I understand the anger before. I feel like one thing that does happen in the various communities, in the gaming community and even in just in regular in other media content, where people just get so angry at stuff before they even experience it, or they'll just go, that thing fucking sucks. They're like, have you seen or played it yet? No. Well, then what if you just experienced it and then made the judgment?
Well, that's what bothers me is like with this whole E3 thing is just people are really upset and like it's almost like this the government is implanting this box in your house, but you don't have to spend money on a console that you don't like. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I mean, like somebody said, I was reading a comment thread about Microsoft's announcement today and they said like, oh, it's too little too late. I'm like, how is it too late? Like,
I know. Some guy got mad at me because I posted the story that like they reversed all the stuff that people were mad about. And he was like, they only did it because of soft sales, not because of the gamers. So fuck them. And I'm like, but you got what you wanted. I don't give a shit why they did it.
Not only that, like every company, every move that every company makes is to make more money in the end because they need to keep the company going.
They're a public company. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Exactly.
And I think it's important that people sort of know that going in that look, that it's people do things as a business. However, doing things that people like and that fans appreciate is also good business. So, but it is at the end of the day, these people, and I always try to be very clear, you know, it's a business. And if I don't run a good business, the people I have lose their jobs. Yeah. And so I think it's important to do things that make a good business. On the other hand, the gamers have every right to say, you know, fuck you, that's not for me. Mm-hmm. And they should exercise that right completely. And I think that's their old, at the end of the day, they're the ultimate authority. I think that sometimes they might, you know, the emotion can get in the way of actually like judging what they might actually like and what might not like. But at the end of the day, it's entirely their prerogative. Like you can never tell somebody, especially a customer, you know, essentially, mm-hmm. feel this way or feel that way. But there is good business in making people feel like appreciated and good and listened to. That's really, really important. That's why I'm on Twitter as much as I am. Trust me, it's not because I like having people call me douchebag at 2 a.m. You know,
I personally love it.
Yeah, when you did that to me, when you call me douchebag, do you get all? How much do you get?
You know, I got to be honest. I think it's probably realistically, it's probably
it's not as bad as you say it is.
Well, it's not as bad as I say it is because I'm sure the majority of where it happens is not at me. I'm sure it just happens in forums that I don't go on.
Right.
But I would say it's like 85% of the people are really nice and 15% of the people are, you know, are really mean and, you know, and I've gotten a lot. Aww. No, it's fine. It's totally fine. And it is. Yeah. It's like, I don't need everyone to like me. My only thing is like, hey, you know, you don't have to go out. If you don't like something, then just you don't have to go out of your way to walk up to someone and go, excuse me. Fuck you.
I get that. There's that great, you ever see that Curb Your Enthusiasm where like Larry David calls somebody to do a recommendation for some assistant he had, like, you know, for another, and he goes, oh, I'm Larry David. I did Seinfeld. He goes, never saw it, not a fan. And he goes, and he's like, why did you have to tell me that?
I didn't saw that part.
But you know, actually Meredith and I, my wife and I we have some of our favorite trolls and we kind of miss them when they go away because they are real, like the anger is eventually, like, if you look at it the right way, it's really entertaining.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, there's no question.
You can't let it get to you because then they win.
Never feed.
There's some people where I'm like, I'm going to send you some WD-40 to unstick that caps lock button. Because clearly it's stuck because it's all caps all the time.
You only have to push it once and then it just...
And then it just comes right and then it just sticks. Caps, yeah. I always...
Well, it's a lot easier than having to hit the shift, like, repeatedly. Like,
yeah, no, that's true.
Leave it that way.
but that being said, it is... I weirdly think that, like, you know, like running a game studio or creating a game is sort of a brave profession because you know that every choice that you make is in some way going to divide people. Yeah. And, you know, they're gonna let you know. And so it is sort of a... I'm not saying it's like a war, but there is a little bit of a, wow, I know that, you know, whatever I do, because as someone, you know, like if you play games, you take great ownership over the story. Like BioShock Infinite is kind of not yours. It's everyone's.
It's everybody's. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, choices that you make, you know, particularly with whatever you do next with it, or like people might go, no, that's wrong. And you're like, really? Yeah, but I thought of it. But you have to be okay with that because it doesn't really belong to you anymore.
Actually, like I heard a podcast or someone about Infinite. They were saying, and they had an interpretation of something that happened. And they said, if I find out that actually it means this, I'm going to be so mad. I'm like, how are you going to find out? Like, how could it mean anything than what you thought it meant? Like, it's not mine. And that's what I'm saying. It's like, it's not ours. Whatever you think about it. And that's why I'm so reluctant to answer some of those questions. It's, the authorial intent doesn't really matter that much. Like, after you've written a couple of things and you go and you read and you've read, like, people have written their theses on various BioShock things and you read and you realize that most academia is complete bullshit because, you know, like, it's all people's interpretations of things. And generally they give a lot more credit to the thought process of the creator than the creator is usually like, it's 3 a.m, you're trying to get something done and you don't plan things out nearly as carefully as sometimes people think they do. Like, I read a whole thesis on BioShock 1 and the naming of the characters, how all the names were taken from all these sort of literary and historical precedents. And really, I just pulled them out of my ass.
But, maybe on a subconscious level, you actually were doing that. You just didn't realize it.
Yeah. I didn't realize how smart I actually am.
but you know, your brain has a lot of, Your brain has a lifetime's worth of stuff in there that influences you, and most of it you're just not aware of. So maybe you did, but again,
if it's fun for the person, does it matter? That person enjoys it. I think it's great. You know,
was there anything that you is there anything about your work in general that you discovered after you made it? Because I feel like sometimes you can make a thing, but when you see it in front of you, and then you go, oh, I guess I really was trying to express this thing that I didn't understand before.
Like there was somebody pointed out, like. So there's, if you know, there's a Cyndi Lauper song playing.
Yes. Girls Just Want to Have Fun.
When you're on the beach. And I knew that was the right sound. Like we had this whole idea that we would take these modern songs and repurpose them for the period.
Tears for Fears,
Creedence, Beach Boys.
Yeah.
And the Cyndi Lauper song just sounded right for that point for me. And Girls Just Want to Have Fun. Lizzie was out for the first time having a good time. But apparently there's a line in that song. Says some men just want to take a beautiful girl and hide her away from the rest of the world.
I read this whole thing that you're referring to. Like they went through every single song and explained why it fit into the fact
that it was that particular, that line. I totally didn't recall that line in the song. So that was a complete happy accident. Like that particular line.
That's so funny.
And it's one of those things where you're like, oh, well played, Levine.
Because I was sitting there, I'm like, oh, this is way deeper than I thought. Yeah.
You know, a lot of them were, like a lot of them had a lot of deeper, but that particular line, which is so accurate about Elizabeth, you know, exactly describing her situation was complete happenstance.
So, you know, the time travel element, I didn't fully... Was Fink jumping forward in time somehow?
I'll let you say. I was like, I was about to explain it, but let you.
Go ahead. I'd rather you explain.
Chloe's going to explain what she thinks.
Game. There was an audio log.
The audio log?
Basically, he found there was a tear that was in his studio, and he started hearing these songs coming through the tear.
So he heard
the songs, and so he started to rewrite
his
songs.
His brother, Fink's brother.
Oh, his brother. Yeah, sorry.
So they were both borrowing, both Fink and his brother. One was borrowing music. The brother is a musician. Fink was leaning more towards the science and industry aspect of it.
Interesting. I want to shift a little bit off BioShock because we don't have a ton of time left, and I've got to talk to you about Logan's Run, which is, I think, so I mean, just the idea of the story that you are writing this movie is so huge because it legitimizes gaming as, I mean, I don't, obviously, you know, everyone plays games and the industry's, you know, like people pay millions of dollars and games outsell films. And, but I feel like from a creative standpoint, it legitimizes what you guys do in the rest of entertainment, which I feel like for the longest time, having grown up with games, I feel like the rest of entertainment is like, ah, games, that's kid stuff. You know, like it's the same way that sort of film looks down on television and television looks down on the internet. And, you know, there was a pecking order. And I feel like now that is something that helps legitimize it as a real storytelling medium, which is pretty, I think it's very exciting.
I think that, I think you're right in a lot of ways that the, and, you know, I've always felt this, that, you know, creative people are creative people. And like, you know, when I talk to a guy like Guillermo, who's going to work in games, as long as, you know, they're going to put, you know, their heart into something, like, of course, Guillermo del Toro could make a, be involved in making a great game. Of course, he's a really talented guy and he's a nerd, you know, like he cares, he's passionate about this stuff. But for some reason, that's only that
it's in that direction.
It's gone that way. And I've had meetings before where people said to me, oh, you know what you should do? Why don't you and this sort of big film director work together? We can put you in a room with him and you can help him make a game. And I'm like, it's not, you know, that's not particularly interesting. In the same way, he's probably not going to come to me and say, oh, help me direct a movie.
Right.
You know, he's a creative guy who can totally handle that on his own. And if I were to do a movie, you know, that's something I would just do. And I would have to convince somebody with the money to, you know, to make that happen. But for some reason, it's, games have been viewed as junior varsity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's very common. That's been very common in Hollywood. But until you start, there are people until you meet the right people who you know, can recognize that, oh, maybe this guy might have something to say, you know, in this medium as well. And I think it's really good for games. I think it's really good for not just for gamers and games. I think it's just good for if there are people who are passionate about things, you know, if they can demonstrate an ability to do it, why should they just be, you know, doing it in one area? And this project in particular, I mean, Logan was something that if not for Logan's Run, there is no BioShock. You know, this whole dystopian, that's the, when I was 10 years old, I saw Logan's Run, and I remember there was a trailer for it. And it's not, you know, the original is, it's a movie of its time, right? It's a very,
it doesn't, I, listen, time. I hope I'm not upsetting anyone when I say this, but it doesn't necessarily hold up, like, all the years.
Oh my God, hold on, I gotta tweet at you.
Please do.
You're a douchebag.
No, it's not 2 a.m. but
the concept is great.
It's so great.
And it deserves, I felt the concept is so strong. And I've read the book 100 times and I've seen the movie 100 times. They have a lot of problems, but the concept has stayed with me for 30 something years. And it was the thing that turned me on to dystopian stories. And so if not for that, then I never would have read 1984. I never would have read Ridden Rider. And then there would have been no dystopian game. So I feel a responsibility as a creator to say, like, I love this thing. The same way that I was, thought Objectivism and Art Deco were interesting and cool, and I wanted to make something that could show other people, like, hey, you know, if you said Art Deco to a gamer 10 years ago, they'd be like, for the average gamer, they're probably like, you know, I don't know, Objectivism. You have to find a way where you say, like, this is cool and here's why it's cool. And the same with Logan's, that as I'm just, as a nerd, it was so, such a part of my birth as a, you know, as a nerd, creative nerd, that I felt for my whole life, this is something I really, I wanted to make popular. I wanted to show people why it was cool. And that's really the impetus behind it, that I just want people to see why it's cool. And again, it's buried under all this 70s stuff, or the book under all this sort of 60s stuff and some, you know, goofy special effects and all that. But there's something deep down that is so compelling that I just want to bring out.
I always love those too. The not just the dystopian future, but also the idea that there's some non-corporeal consciousness that controls everything, whether it be a computer or just like some weird hive mind, or like the, I don't know, even if it's like the Kryptonian Council, or just like some weird group that somehow has wrestled control to say, you know, to reorganize society.
Right. And they have a better idea of how your life should run than you should.
Yeah, exactly.
It's got great ideas, and it comes from a time before people knew how to turn science fiction into popular, like science fiction back then was, you know, it was sort of, oh yeah, we'll do a science fiction movie every, it was like one science fiction movie a year. I mean, I'm 46 and I was, I don't know how old you were, when I was growing up, there was like one year there was Rollerball and the next year there was Logan's Run and the next year there was Westworld.
Westworld and then the Westworld sequel.
Yes. And that was like, but like, it was like one or two a year. You know? And then Star Wars hit and then all of a sudden people realized there was, you know, there was money in the banana stand and they started, you know.
Good reference.
I'm five episodes into the new Arrested Developments.
You got to see the sixth one is where it really
starts. Is it really starts coming? Yeah. It's all, everything's starting to sort of come together now.
The Job one and the Anne and Job. You got to, you'll see.
Oh my God. So if that, oh fuck, that's a great reference.
But it's true. People, they didn't think there was money there. And then all of a sudden they realized there was money there. And then people started, and the same like superhero. Like when I was a kid, there were no superhero movie. There was like a Spider-Man television show, and it was terrible.
Oh, it was really bad. You know, it's funny you say that because I was just telling our friend Matt Key, who is the biggest comic book. He's probably the biggest comic book nerd I know, and Matt had no idea that there was a '70s Spider-Man TV show.
Oh yeah.
And he was like, what? Well, first of all, he didn't know about the Shazam show. Hello? He didn't know about Shazam. And I was like, yeah, there was a Shazam show. And it sort of looked Croft-esque.
Right.
But it wasn't. It was, who did that one? It was Shimer. I think it was Shimer, maybe. Oh, fuck, I don't remember. Anyway. The Spider-Man show in the 70s.
Remember the web shooter?
The web shooter,
outside,
And it just looked like, the web shooter on the outside. And it just looked like
rope.
It's on YouTube. It's on. I follow a great subreddit called Obscure Media, and if you go to Obscure Media, if you follow this Obscure Media subreddit, it's all these old fucking awesome things are just literally Obscure Media. Like I saw the other day, I saw like a failed Munsters animated pilot called like Little Munsters or something, and then there was a this one I have to share with you because it's. Oh no, that's Bryan Cranston's top five Reddit moments. this is a 1960. Oh, I think I closed it. It was just this weird, like Octoman. It was like a 1971 movie where there was like a part octopus guy.
Are you subscribed to R Space Dicks?
No one should subscribe. Don't. Bam. Don't do that.
R Space Dicks.
Don't do it. No, don't do it. Don't do it.
All right. We'll go easy. How about R Dragons Fucking Cars? Are we on that one?
That one's better. Yeah, that one's better. So what is your idea to with Logan's Run? All these years, it's been in your gut. So what do you think could have been better about the original Logan's Run? Because I think it's important for people to know that this isn't just like, oh, they're going to let the video game guy make another remake. Like that this is a very passionate thing that you probably watch this movie for years and be like, oh, yeah. If I were to do it.
I haven't started writing it. I've just been mostly thinking about it and. But I think the key thing is that there's a bunch of challenges that are in the way of making that story accessible. I mean, one is that it's really hard to get on board with Logan because he likes to kill people and then until it's his time to die. And then he's like, well, I'm not going to do that anymore.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And then Jessica is not particularly a strong or interesting character. She's just sort of, she's very much a female sidekick of the period. And I think that would, you know, what's her deal? Like, what does she want? And why is she interested in this guy?
He finds her on that three-dimensional fuck stream, right? Where he just tunes her in. He's like, let's do it.
Yep.
There's a show going on downstairs. That's the bleed over the noise. But was it Jenny Agutter?
Jenny Agutter, yes.
Yeah. She was the
American Werewolf in London also.
Yes, of course. Yes.
The shower scene did not go through your head right now.
No, of course not.
Of course not. There are some things that you would, that in terms of the characters, in terms of, you know, buying into them, buying into the world that are in the way that I think you have to sort of like figure out.
Yeah.
And, I'm in the process of that, but because there's this great nougaty middle that's like got this sort of very tough shell on the outside.
Right.
And you want to deal with that shell so people can get to the nougaty middle because there is that great dystopian nougaty middle.
Do you sort of feel like that there's that the nougaty middle is sort of kind of what happened at E3, what's happened in gaming, is that there is this consciousness that's saying, here, this is good for you, and people going, no! Like, that's sort of the revolution?
I'm drawing a comparison
to the Logan's Run reality of the consciousness and the dystopian society, and you know, like there's basically this pleasure society that that the government or whatever the body is just telling them what's good for them, and then now, but then at some point, you know, like they revolt.
Well, I think to some degree you're right that like you can't just tell people the society or the game or the hardware you're selling is great. Like getting people to believe it is the hard part, buy into it, you know?
Right.
And that's with any dystopian story. Like the reason, you know, I think Rapture worked was because we started the beginning of the game as with the guy telling you why it was awesome, with Ryan telling you, making the case for it. And I think that's the hard thing for any kind of dystopian society. It has to start like Brave New World is not really, it's just a it's not really dystopian because it never was. Sorry, I'm 1984. There's nothing appealing about it. But great, what I loved about when I first saw the trailer for Logan's Run when I was a kid, I remember it said like in the 23rd century, like you can have all the drugs and all the sex and all this great stuff and it's awesome, but there's only one catch. And I remember like that was like a lightning bolt hitting my head that you could have this sort of dichotomy of this amazing world that is perfect except in this one little very profound way. And the problem is that case you have to make that was made really well in the trailer wasn't made as well in the movie.
Like why are they killing people in care? Why are they lighting them up in carousel?
Yeah, you know, and it you kind of walk away feeling a little that scene. I watched it again last night, and you walk away saying like, oh, I'm not sure I'd be one of those people cheering in that crowd. And you have to think
it's awesome.
Yes. Yep.
Because your value, you have to take your audience on a journey, and their you have to shift their values throughout the movie,
yes.
Right?
Yeah, they have to buy into why somebody else would buy into this. And I think that, you know, in we spent a lot of time in, like, that's why Rapture is beautiful, you know, like, because we had people understand, like, why would you want to live here? And there's a lot of people who cosplay, like, these games, because I think there's something very appealing about both Columbia and Rapture. You know, with Columbia was this sort of notion of old-timey America, and where, you know, this little, like the Music Man, like that was what I told the guys. It's like, it should feel like the Music Man, this perfect turn of the century world that never really existed. But who wouldn't want to kind of live in that world if that could exist? But then there's this very dark, well, yeah, there's this, but then the catch is there's this really dark underbelly that is, you know, which was true at the time. Like people remember this time in America where everybody was happy and everyone was perfect. And of course it never fucking existed.
Yeah.
There were things about it that were great and things about it that were, you know,
really not great.
Really not so great.
Yeah.
So I have some questions here.
I have one quick question before. I know we got to rush, but I just have one really quick question.
Sure.
I want to know what like the game industry right now, it's kind of being revolutionized. It's a bit of a clusterfuck because on one hand we have all these indie games that are starting to like pick up. We've got like Minecraft was an indie game and Journey, and then on the other hand we have like Call of Duty making billions of dollars, and then we've got beautiful games like yours which is starting to get more recognition. People are playing it, and so I mean people rejected the idea of DRM, which would have sort of made gaming sort of more of an internal thing. I think, I mean, where do you think this is going, like, you know, with movies and games? And
I think people reject the notion of you haven't told me why it's good for me. Mm-hmm. Like if you look at Steam, for instance, I think that there's this term in like somebody told me when I was coming up, when I was starting, you know, run the company and stuff, called, you know, value proposition, like, you know, it's like any pitch, like I'll give you this hamburger and fries and a shake for $6. You're like, great. Then he says, well, for $150, like, well, that's not a good value proposition. Mm-hmm. And the same way with Steam has a package of stuff they give you, you know, one is DRM, for instance, and one is you can't resell your games. But it's also like, oh, by the way, you know how you hate when you get a new computer that you have to drag out all your discs and do that? You know, you hate when you have to track down patches, you know, you hate, you know, not having easy ways to mod your games. Well, we're gonna take care of all that for you. Hey, you know you hate there are no good sales on games. We're gonna take care of all that for you. And that's what it's about. I don't think it's about any particular thing. I think it's about, am I making a good proposition to you? And the audience is always gonna be the one who tells you whether it's a good proposition. You can never tell them. And they're gonna answer that question. And sometimes, you know, people like digital downloads, you know, for instance, right now if you download a game on you know, from PSN or something, there's DRM. You can't resell it, but the convenience for some people is worthwhile, and they feel comfortable with it. But if they're not comfortable with it, there's no amount of telling them they should be comfortable with this.
So there has to be a compelling reason to make the compromise.
Yeah. There has to be a value add to them that, like anything, like with Bioshock Infinite, I can't beat somebody up so they buy the game. I can't tell them it's awesome. Like a lot of people, I remember somebody said to me when we were working on Infinite, tell me why I should pre-order your game. And I said, I'm not going to do that because why should you believe me? You know, yeah. Like at the end of the day, you'll pre-order it or you won't pre-order it if you think it's cool. And, you know, it's really up to you. I'm the last guy you should listen to. You know, even if I didn't care about money or anything like that, which of course I don't. it's my baby. So I have a vested interest in loving it. You know, yeah. I've worked on it forever.
And the question is your baby going to be in the crib when you open the door?
That's right. Well, maybe it will be and won't be.
Oh, shit.
Take that, Hardwick.
But now that we've burnt down this sort of model.
I will take it, or maybe I won't take it.
Oh, keeping it going. Yep, she's going with that.
Sorry.
Maybe she's your girlfriend. Maybe she's your girlfriend and your daughter.
Oh, God, I shouldn't
be. Play that.
No, I shouldn't be turned on right now. I have a guilt boner. I'm sorry. I'm Dr. Manhattan's penis again.
Give a blue guilt boner.
A blue guilt boner. Oh, my God, blue guilt boner's playing at Spaceland tonight. You guys want to go see him?
Yeah, I love those guys.
They're so good.
Yeah. But now that they've, sorry, to go back from the
go,
voters,
go, 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 go.
Now that they've burned down this sort of model to the ground, do you think that games are going to be going more in the direction of multi-million dollar franchises, or do you think they're going to be going more indie?
I think that...
Are we going to just be split right down the middle?
Look, the great thing about digital distribution is it lowers the barriers to directly communicating with your audience, and it allows ways to like a game like Minecraft. It's an indie game that sold, I don't know, 14 whatever million
units.
A
ridiculous amount.
Now it's a bit of an outlier, right? Because there's something so clever about it. It's, you know, somebody, a friend of mine described it as it's Lego for, you know, it's modern day Lego. It's digital Lego.
Lego zombie game.
Yeah, and it allows expression and all those things that games that it's a very beautiful and brilliant idea. And not every idea is that. So most indie games aren't going to go anywhere near that. It's sort of an outlier phenomena. But I think that as people get more and more comfortable with digital distribution, the amount of people in the middle get reduced so greatly, the barrier of entry gets reduced so greatly that you can service much smaller audiences with much more niche stuff. And you can make money off of that. Like you can, you know, you couldn't, there was no way to make, like I got out of PC game development a few years ago. Oh, I was out of strictly PC game development because the kind of games I was making that were $3-5 million development, like Tri's Vengeance and SWAT and Freedom Force. There was just a market was disappearing because the cost to get that on the shelf was so expensive that people were going to say, well, why am I going to buy your $3-4 million game when I can buy somebody spent $20 million on a game or $30 million? But now, there was no way to service a niche audience. Now you can totally service niche audience, and you can make a lot of money doing it. So I'm very optimistic about the future. I think quality. Are you going to make something of quality? That's what it always comes down to. It doesn't matter if it's on an iPad or an Xbox or a PC. Can you make something of quality that is going to appeal to an audience? And I think that's great.
Not only just with gaming, but with anything, it's always that magic formula that it's like, well, yeah, if you make a good story, it doesn't matter if it's a movie or a game or a television show or a comic book or what, as long as it's a story that, you know, that's good. And but that's the magic molecule is like, but you can't just engineer that, like you just have to, like someone has to come along and make it.
But that's the nice thing about this sort of atomization that happens is you get, instead of having three or, I don't know, I mean, there probably be room for these huge giant blockbusters, but you're seeing is the same thing happen in television. Like, you know, you do the show, right? The Talking Dead, which is about, which is centered on a very successful television show. Now that television show was 25 years ago. It would not be a successful television show. What is it? 8 or 9 million people watching, which is huge, huge numbers. But if you weren't 20 million people, like when there's only three stations, if you didn't have 20 million people watching your show, but that's a great thing, right? Because now you can have a show that's incredibly successful that caters to an audience of 8 or 9 million people that doesn't have to make any compromise
prizes for,
right.
Well, my great aunt in, you know, Manitoba wants to watch it, so we better have a lovable kid,
right.
You know, so you don't have to do any of those compromises. You don't have to have Cousin Oliver.
Are you worried that we're going to see the quality? Do you think the quality is going to lower over time? Because
no, I think it will go up because you can make audio, you can make quality things that you, because of like Netflix, they have a new model, which is allows them to focus on, you know, somebody said recently that, you know, what used to be movies, like real, like adult movies are now, not only porn, I mean like movies for, are now TV, you know, like,
yeah.
They're now The Walking Dead. It's now Breaking Bad. It's now Mad Men. And, you know, because the map market of big movies, now you can only do huge blockbusters, really. There's only an economic for that. But there's Netflix and there's TV. There's a million cable shows and there's direct distribution. And there's all these other ways people are finding ways to and YouTube and all these other ways people are finding to make money. And I think that's great. When we were kids, there was three channels, you know,
yeah.
And that was it. And if you weren't, if you couldn't find something that appealed to that many people, that meant by definition, it was sort of a middling, lowest common denominator approach.
Yeah.
Well, and then people had to, whereas now, you know, we as consumers are very spoiled because we have tasted what it feels like to get our very specific desires met. And we don't have to anymore. Like when we were growing up, it was like, well, if you want to watch TV, you better fucking figure out a way to like one of the things that's exactly. on, because otherwise you're not going to, or, you know, you have to get pirated tapes from England if you want to watch, you know, like, you know, you want to watch Python or whatever, yep. if you can't catch it on PBS. So it's sort of like, now we're so used to the idea of like, oh, well, I want exactly what I want when I want it. And it better be delivered in the specific way that is suited to me or fuck everything.
Right. Right.
And that's what we've sort of come to, you know, that's what we've come to expect. I want to get to some Reddit questions.
The first, I won't ask anybody.
The biggest Reddit question, of course, is DLC. You know, what with the buying the season pass and DLC, and you know, when's that happening, and what are your plans? And
so, this was a really interesting conundrum we got ourselves into because we very carefully listened to the audience about pass off something that you didn't put in the game as DLC you're selling us. So now what that meant is we had to wait to finish the game to start on anything. And this is one of those things I actually think the intensity of the audience feeling about this may actually be a negative, because there's stuff that we cut from the game because it didn't work at all in the game, which we could put in the DLC because we think it's actually, well, this has a role here, which now we're not going to.
Can you say any of it?
Will get mad.
Yeah, there's
right?
There's some character models and stuff that we thought really cool that just didn't, whether it turned out that our memory, we couldn't load that many models at one time or something like that, that we just didn't find a place in the game. And now I'm not going to put them anywhere near the DLC because...
Can I speak on behalf of gamers and say it's okay? Because I would love to see some of those character models.
We're going to try to find a way to get it out there for free so people can see it in some way. Okay. But it's kind of a shame because that basically means that now our toolbox for the DLC is lower. But I took that very, very seriously, that people felt really strongly about it. And now I've got people on my Twitter feed saying, like, where's the fucking DLC? And the truth is we started afterwards. And I get why people are impatient for the DLC. But on the other hand, we're kind of trapped between a rock and a hard place. And we're trying to do what's – at the end of the day, I'll take that because I want to do what's best for the audience and I want to make them happy. And if some people get pissed off – generally the audience is – but the Twitter followers are very much like, no, we get it. We get why you're doing it. And we know, look, we're working since the game finished. Basically, we've been working nonstop on it, but these things take time and we'll talk about it relatively soon. But I don't like to just to pump out information that doesn't, like, I can't say, oh, hey, it's going to be, I want to show people why it's cool. I want to be, when we're ready to show people why it's cool, we're going to do that. And I think people are going to find it to be very, very cool. I'll take the sort of negativity about it.
Have you given people a relative time frame, like, it'll be 6 months or in 2014 or?
I don't want.
You don't want to say.
I don't want to do that yet. I will say that we go to work and that's all we do.
It's tough because if you do give people a time frame and when that rolls around, if you're ready, like, hey, but you said the blah, blah, blah. Like, you have to be very, you have to be very careful what you say.
And that's what I'm saying. To some degree, I think what the intensity people feel over things like this DLC issue cannot necessarily be a good thing for them, but I am trying, by the end of the day, I am trying to respect what they want, and that's why we won't ship any of this content. It would just basically go away.
Right.
Because there are things you do cut from a game. And like the notion that you cut things there's no way I can that's just not how it works for us.
Mm-hmm.
The things that generally we would cut would be so far from being able to be used anyway. Like there are levels that we just sort of
okay. When you said that, I thought what you were saying was you were afraid to put in the DLC because people would be upset that they were paying for something that they'd already paid.
There's nothing like a level, but there are character models, for instance, right. that we had in the game that we realized, oh, we can only load 7 civilians at a time, mm-hmm. so we couldn't ever use this model. Or there was an enemy that end of the day just wasn't very fun to play against, but his character model is really cool.
Yeah.
But we won't ship any of that because I don't want the reaction of people to be, how come you are making us pay for this?
Oh, that's okay. So you were saying
that. Yeah, I was saying that.
See, it's such a bummer. I you know, people just get so upset. And I think that really should change. And I will go on record saying that. You guys don't have to, but I think that people get so...
It's for me as a gamer, like there used to be this thing called expansion packs.
Right.
Yeah. Like it's not a new thing. DLC is not a new thing. But at the end of the day, look, I respect that people open their wallets and pay for these things. So I want people to feel good about it. In the end of the day, I'm not necessarily sure it's in their best interest that, as you said, because they won't get this content.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to make them feel like they are paying twice for something,
yeah.
But they're not. But at the end of the day, I want to respect that. But I don't know if it's necessarily there are unintended consequences they may not necessarily see.
Well, this is a really good way to point out the consequences that come from that. So,
This is from MTI Chris. This is an easy one. What do you like on your pizza?
I'm a vegetarian, so that's like the most boring question to ask me. Yeah. Also, him? No.
No. Well, ish. Not really.
I'm partially vegetarian because she is, and there are some great vegetarian restaurants to eat at. And I found that, you know, I was such a carnivore that I was like, oh, you know, if I don't really feel like eating meat, I won't eat it. But sometimes I really do. So I eat it some of the time, and other times,
My wife was she was a vegetarian. And then she, you want me outing you on this one? and then she found it like she was getting really tired and stuff. So she started eating meat again sometimes. And I think for some people, I think some people thought it was like it doesn't bother me. Like I wouldn't, that's fine. Like a lot of people think you have to be a boat bee.
Yeah. You got to eat it sometimes.
But for me, it's, I just, you know, so yeah. What do you get on your pizza?
I used to before I was vegetarian, I used to really like ham and pineapple and peppers.
You're a Hawaiian pizza.
I like that, yeah, and red onions, and then I just get it without the ham.
do you have any like artificial meat ever on your pizza?
I haven't, no.
We do this, we go to this Thai restaurant that's really good.
Mulan, shout out.
This is from Biscuit Hammer. This is a spoiler question.
You
didn't answer your pizza question?
You weren't interested in our really deep conversation about artificial meats on pizza. I get on my birthday, here's the best pizza I have. My birthday, my wife makes me, she comes buys this dough from this restaurant, and she comes home and she makes me a pizza with onions and fake pepperoni and fake sausage, and it's like the best thing ever. Every year.
That's really sweet.
That sounds delicious. Biscuit Hammer has a couple questions that are pretty good. Are we ever going to get closure for Robert and Rosalind Lutece? Their existence at the end of the game is questionable, and I really like those two. And then this person asked if they were doing it.
I
think they're the same person in different universes, right?
Yes, that's true. They are. I will say that because that's on the record. In terms of whether they're doing it, that is not my call to make.
So that's either technically masturbation. It's technically interdimensional masturbation.
Ain't nothing wrong with that.
No, you can fuck your opposite sex self through a window in the universe.
Almost everybody I met said if they could meet themselves, they would have sex with themselves. And I'm like, have you seen me? Like I would not have sex with myself. I'm a big hairy monster.
So his other question was, have you considered making a game more on the line of Telltale, like The Walking Dead? Sometimes I feel like the Bioshock games were somewhat hampered by certain gamey elements, and it would be interesting to see you be able to cut loose from a storytelling perspective, which I think in the broader sense, a bunch of people were like, open world, why not Bioshock open world?
Yeah. Well, Walking Dead game is really focused on the narrative, right? Like the game element of actually is very, the Telltale Walking Dead game, right, is actually very from a game perspective, is actually fairly limited by design. And so they did, you know, and they did a great job. They create these great characters and these great situations. I think for me, I've always liked gamey, like gaminess. You know, I've always enjoyed game systems. You know, but when I play games, actually, generally what I play is I tend to play like Civilization, XCOM style games, more systemic games rather than narrative games. So I think that I would have trouble. Like I had to work on an adventure style game once, a Star Trek game for a while that never got made. And it was really hard for me to come up with like the moments in it because they were so, that's all there was to the game. It was like these sort of player designer design moments, like any adventure game, you know, cause you know, in any Sierra style game, you know exactly the points along. You can sort of plot the path along very clearly. There's no systemic growth or anything like that. So as much as I appreciate it, and as much as that would make my life easier as a writer, I would miss working on as a gamer, I like game systems. So probably not.
I liked just because I got stuck on Skyrim for so long, an open world game is dangerous for me because it's difficult for me to get off it. And so having basically one direction.
The band?
Yep, the band. Having one direction in my life has really helped me realize that I'm a 13-year-old girl. but having basically like one really main quest to accomplish and get through just a linear story is better for me and my personality, because I would fucking play it forever. I mean, because Columbia is just one of those places where you go, oh, I want to fucking live here. And I would just run around that place all the time.
So the question is like, what I think about an open world game?
Walking
Dead is an open world.
It is an open world. But I was saying that was the Walking Dead question, the gamey elements. And then I said in the broader sense, other people it was actually two questions. Other people on Reddit want to know like, why not an open world?
Rapture was open world.
I think those are the designs I admire the most. I think those are incredibly difficult. Like we talked about Red Dead, like having those moments that are just entirely your own, you know, that come out. I really admire those. They're very difficult to do correctly, and they're difficult to. Then even as open as Infinite was, I mean, I don't mean in terms of like it wasn't an open world game by a stretch, but the fact that like. Where, you know, not having cutscenes and like having trying to tell that narrative and as vertically a vertical space and as open a space as it was really, really difficult. So I would love to do a game like that. I just think I would have to really think about how it would be done.
Oh, please do it.
This Redditor Vittorius has a couple good questions. Number one, did you really do the voice of the Circus of Values clown?
Welcome to the Circus of Values. My wife hates that fucking voice. I did. As my acting, my amazing acting.
That's fantastic. Could you do it one more time and we won't talk under you, and then could people rip it and do it and make it their ringtone?
Well, it's already in the game, isn't it?
Yeah, but you doing it means we get to control a puppet.
All right, I'll give you two lines. Ready?
Okay.
Welcome to the Circus of Values. Come back when you got some money, buddy.
Sweet. Sweet.
So great.
I'm in demand in LA for my acting.
Well, it's such an iconic sound in the game. Like when I hopped into Infinite and I heard that voice, I was just like, oh God, home.
You see, I've grown as an actor. Now I've played the vending machine in the new game too. I've really developed as an actor.
then you could be some sort of a sentient apartment in Logan's Run. Hey, Logan.
Hey, Logan.
Oh, you have to do it now.
Warner Brothers just ripped up the agreement.
Oh, you didn't say he was going to be a voice of this thing.
He's going to be a robot voice.
No, fuck this. And then Vittorius also want to know, who would win in a debate, Comstock or Ryan?
Ooh, that's a good one.
Well, that would be hard because that would be like, you know, well, I mean, one of them is an atheist. So, you know, that would be a tough one. I think they wouldn't have a lot of common ground to even debate upon. I mean, I guess I would think the atheist would win in some
ways. That's my answer.
As an atheist, Comstock would have a hard time winning in that debate, in my view.
Yeah.
This is from Bloodnick. What lessons have you learned from Bioshock Infinite that you are going to take on to future projects with you?
You know, you think I think I've learned, well, something we learned a lot about, like, telling story and narrative and things like that. I don't think I've, like, said, oh my God, I'm never going to do that again, you know, anything from the game. I think that I don't necessarily like to repeat ourselves as much. I think that I'd be very, I don't know. I guess the answer is I don't know about that. I don't think I learned very much. I'd like try to answer, give you a smart answer, but I don't know. I don't know if I took away lessons or small things like, hey, like let's balance the weapon. This kind of weapon should be balanced that way, or that kind of weapon should be balanced that way. But most things that happen in that game in that period of time that weren't what we wanted to be was really a function of time and production, you know, production limitations and things like that. Like when I finished Bioshock 1, I was definitely like, wow, the third, I really shouldn't have killed off Ryan when I did. Because it left the last third of the game really with not a lot left to do. But I don't really have any big takeaways like that this time. There are things that people, you know, that I like more and like less, but nothing that I like big solid takeaways.
Are you okay? Are you good with completion in the sense of, can you walk away from it and go, that's, you know, that's done. We finished it. We're like when everything was done and it was delivered, did you feel that your soul was satisfied? Like, this is it. Or are you still like, oh, if I could just die. Are you a noodler?
I could noodle on it forever. I think I know that it's probably not a good idea. Like, you know, I think it's done. Like, I think that game is done and I could noodle on it forever, but I don't think that's necessarily productive.
It's hard because I'm sure that, you know, especially 4.5 years of your life is a significant amount of time to spend on one thing. Yeah. I mean, that's, people could have numerous jobs and do numerous things in 4.5 years that, you know, that I often wonder when you're working on something that long, how do you retain your enthusiasm for that thing at year three when you're like, we're 3 years in, we still got another year left. I mean, it's like, you know, hour 8 of a 16-hour flight.
But that's never a problem because it's constantly evolving for me always. Like I'm always trying to make it better and the team's always trying to make it better. And I'm always learning like the pinky stuff. Like, you know, I'll come home one day and like, we'll have thought of that. And all of a sudden, like I'm so enthusiastic again because I feel like, oh, now I've made progress towards telling this story. I don't get fatigue from that. I think that it's not, but I don't necessarily think I think that is a long time to spend on one thing. And I don't think looking at the arc of your life, it's probably you want to spend a little less time on something than more time on something.
Do you think there's going to be any Easter eggs in Logan's Run from Bioshock or any of your favorite games or anything? Sort of like, well, not just Songbird, but you know, it's like, it was like, you know, hearing Ellen McClain in Pac Rim, you know, like as the voice of hearing GLaDOS basically. I mean, when I showed you the trailer for Pac-Rim, you were like, oh my God. Like it totally.
I think I cried a little bit.
A little bit, yeah.
Well, I think that's Guillermo being very smart and realizing that.
He knows his audience.
Well, he's a fan, right?
Yeah.
He's a fan and he knows his audience too. And in this, you know, that we, there's way, it's like, that's, what do you call it? That is fan service, but in a way that's really smart, but also genuine and true to, it doesn't break it for somebody who doesn't, it's not anything less for somebody who doesn't know who she is.
And you also I don't get the sense that he's like, these kids will recognize this. Like, that's obviously a thing he loves and he wanted to pay homage to it. 100%.
He's the real deal.
Did you find a question that you want to ask?
Oh, it's a dumb question. I feel like this might be, well, okay. Somebody says here, what do you think of people getting tattoos? The Dancing Dynamo. He says, what do you think of people getting tattoos of or related to your work? Do you find it flattering or entirely too much? And I think it's really funny because I see people that get the tattoos of the chains.
Yep.
Like, do you guys, why are you getting those?
I think that, you know, I don't think there's anything more flattering than somebody permanently altering their body related to what you do. I think that, I think people find meaning in symbols that sometimes you never even intended. Like the chains came out of Rob Waters, one of our artists, just had that idea, that concept. That didn't come out of, it wasn't something I said, oh, he should have chains on his hand. So I don't even know if Rob, I just thought he thought it was, I'm not sure, I'd have to ask Rob, but I thought Keith just thought it was a cool visual. And when I saw it, I was like, oh, that's great. You know, let's do it. Cause it was, and then people started putting it on their hands and I bet if you ask 10 people what that meant to them, it'll probably get 10 different answers.
Things, yeah.
Because like you probably, you know, what you're saying, I think is very valid, is like, well, they imply that this guy was a slave.
Yeah.
I think probably, but also he broke free, you know, to some degree from that slavery. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe that's, I can't say because I didn't get a tattooed in my hand. I don't have any tattoos, but I'm guessing there's
more for the story of his life rather than just what it actually means.
Because I think a lot of people probably feel, look, you know, you go to some job and you're not thrilled with it. You got some boss, you know, some people probably feel a little bit like, you know, somebody else is pulling the strings on them. And it's maybe their way of saying, well, maybe that's not how I feel about it, you know?
Right.
Here's a good question from Peruka. Seeing as how the actors have a direct impact on characters, how did working with Troy and Courtney change the story of Infinite?
So in a couple ways. One is when you have a strong actor, they make their strengths apparent to you, and then you write to those strengths. If fighting against an actor's strengths is not a great idea. So they both came in very strong as to what the characters I wanted, but they would often, there'd be a line which I would write and that come in and I have it. And I would think like, oh, this is a great line or is this that? And it comes in. And when the actor reads it, it's just not the lines, just not the right line for them. And quite often they would say, well, what if I said this? And they would, you know, recraft the line and something that was more attuned to their voice. And almost every time it was exactly the right thing. They had excellent instincts. They really understood the characters. They really understood what they meant in the larger story. And frankly, they had to put a lot of trust in me because that story was evolving all the time. And there were, you know, things that would change in it that were substantial and they would just roll with the punches. So I think that if you have good actors, you know, you have to put a lot of trust in them. And that was I believe that was probably one of the most trusting creative experiences I've ever been in working with those guys.
So this is just two more questions. Accidentist. This is almost an accidentist.
Oh,
like it's
like accidentist.
Accidentist.
Yeah.
That's oops.
Somebody I wouldn't want to.
That was the guy in the Midwest who gave all those people hepatitis by reusing.
I had a dentist whose name was, his actual name is Dr. Payne. I kid you not.
I have a gynecologist whose name is Dr. Uzi.
I knew a girl whose gynecologist was Dr. Cherry.
Really?
Yeah. What is the name? Oh my God. Whoa, Dr. shit. Uzi. I gotta look him up.
Is it, how's it spelled?
Uzzi. He's Israeli. That's my guy.
Wait a minute. What is his? Oh, yeah. And then my man doctor for this region down here, Dr. Dickey.
Dr.
Oh, no, wait. That's my eye doctor. Dr. Dickey's my eye doctor.
Oh, you don't want to get those two mixed up.
What's a man doctor?
You know, for the wiener.
You have a special penis doctor?
Well, the urologist. Okay.
We call him the Cocter, right?
Okay.
Right? Up top?
Well played.
Cocter who?
Cocter.
Dr. Dickey is for the eyes. Dr. Bender. The urologist. I'm not as not excited about having a urologist named Dr. Bender as he is probably not as excited as having a patient whose last name is Hardwick. this is an unanswerable question, by the way, but I think the soul of it might be something that might inspire. Why do most stories in video games suck? Is it lack of money, time, publishers ruining the game, a combination of all three? What's the biggest hurdle when creating a story in a video game?
I'll give you an example.
Okay.
So when I was working on that Star Trek game I mentioned before, this is my first thing writing ever did in the industry before. And I wrote the cold opener is on a TV show. So I was trying to write a cold opener for the game, you know, which on Star Trek, it's they encounter something and there's a big moment of tension that they cut to commercial.
Da, 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 da.
Yeah, exactly. So the cold opener I wrote was very standard. It was Star Trek Voyager and Janeway. There's like they encountered a ship and the ship opens fire at them, and the last line I remember writing was Janeway's eyes widen as the plasma torpedo approaches the Enterprise or whatever ship, the Voyager. And the guy who was ended up being one of the co-founders of Rational, who was the lead programmer on the game, said, Ken, you see Janeway? And she was like a 64 by 64 pixel Sierra Venture camera. Those eyes are not going to fucking widen. They're not going to reflect anything. And I realized, oh my God, I'm not writing to the media here. I think I'm writing a movie still. I've got to figure out how to write for this media. And I think that's, I think that's the biggest problem is either you have writers who come in from, who aren't in the studio and they get hired as a contractor and they haven't written for games. And, or you have game writers who haven't immersed themselves in storytelling outside of, you know, the Matrix and actually the Matrix is brilliant storytelling, but they've only seen like a few things. They've only seen a few science fiction things. They haven't exposed themselves to, you know, a broader range of storytelling. So like I steal liberally from, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson and Kubrick and all these other people because I'm a huge movie fan. I'm a huge, you know, and so I'll steal from all these. I'm also love science fiction. I love fans, but I steal from a broader range of places. Like I said, the film noir and Thief, for instance. And so their reference points are smaller. And it's also just really hard to write for games because you're not – when you write a screenplay, you can sit down and basically write whatever you want to write. And then they will look at it and figure out, can we do this on a budget or not? And they'll say, well, can you go rewrite the scene without that? But games are – every time you try to change something or write something, it's like, okay, if I want another character in the screen, we can't just hire an extra. It's like somebody's got to go model that character. And you only have 25 models or whatever in the entire game. And you really have to write to the metal, as they say. You know, like you have to write specifically to the assets you have, the resources you have. To the animations you have, to the environments you have, and that's a really acquired skill, and it takes a long time to learn that. For me, remember, I'm the president of the company, so I can put a kind of premium and importance on the narrative that, say, I know I have a good friend who's a writer who isn't the president of the company, and he has to constantly fight for the narrative in a way that I don't have to.
Right.
Because I can say, well, this really matters, and we're going to do it. You know, we're going to spend the money on it. We're going to spend the resources on it, but there's only so many resources and money you have. So that means something else is going to, you know, is going to give way.
Time, money, quality.
Exactly. Exactly.
And you get two.
Yep.
Exactly. And so, you know, so I think game narrative is very, very, very tough. And there's a few other reasons. I'm sure there's probably others that I'm thinking of.
Why is it when I run up to people in Colombia, they won't look at me?
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, like, you also have that basic problem. Like when you have game characters aren't like you, I talked about this for Elizabeth, like when you hire an actor to use a scene, they just bring a certain amount of software with them.
Yeah.
You know, like Elizabeth didn't have any of that software. So the work we did to make her feel natural, and I think the guys did a great job and she ended up feeling very, very natural. We had to think about every single moment, everything the player might do. And she had no software. She had no natural software. You know, she didn't do anything just by default. We had to create all of that. And so with film, you can hire a good actor and we have the voices. We can do that with the voices. The actress can bring that to the voices. But the performance really all had to come out of a million things intersecting and working properly together. We didn't get any benefit of a natural human in the room.
Yeah. One final question. This is from Alpha Nexus. Who would win a no holds barred beard match, your beard or pre 2013 Tim Schafer's beard?
Listen, Schafer. I'll fight. My beard will fucking fight your beard. You name the place, you name the time, and I will be there.
Oh my God.
Well, it's past beard, right?
I think.
Is he not a beard
to go
anymore?
Into the past.
You know pre 2013, yeah.
He pussied out.
I think Manhattan's dick just got a little harder than it was before at this beard talk.
You grow another beard, Schafer, and I'll see you next year.
Beard?
What?
What?
What are you talking about?
He's not gay. He's totally not gay.
Listen, I you know, if I were, I'd be in better shape and dress better.
Oh my God.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Ken Levine. And this was it's been really nice to get to know you a little bit. And we had that phone conversation. I'm like, I want to fucking hang out with this guy. So thank you for spending time. And I hope that we get to hang out offline, you know, whenever you have time or you know, when I'm on the East Coast.
Yeah,
online too, you know. So again, what's your gamer tag? What's your gamer tag? The one question that'll send any game developer into like,
I
do you have a public one?
Major Nelson asked me that several years ago, and I answered him, and that was the stupidest thing I ever did. Especially because like on Xbox Live, like I'm trying to be nice, and like when I would reject people's gamer tag requests, I'd have to like write them a long note, and I'm writing like, all these long notes with that fucking I'm sorry that I already have the full, and I'm sorry that you can't. Don't be hurt. Your feelings hurt. That was not a good time in my life.
You're a people pleaser. Ken, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you guys.
And congratulations on everything. And I can't wait to to see Logan's Run, which is probably still several years away, but I'm excited about it. And thanks to R Gaming for submitting a bunch of questions, and thanks for Matt and Jonah for not being here. So Chloe, you could sit in because you know more about BioShock than they do, quite frankly. Thanks, everyone. Enjoy your burrito.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.